So going to the West Coast, this is my second stop in the West Coast. I thought it would really be appropriate to talk about the landscape, find an esoteric bottle that is not appropriate for anything. And perhaps you can teach us something. And in particular, we have to use flux vacua. So the title has the word minimal, and that has two meanings. First, I'll present the simplest possible flux vacuum. And we will see that even that simplest possible flux vacuum does some surprising things that, in hindsight, do not contradict anything, but I was certainly surprised to see them. And this, of course, opens the door for many, many other surprises in more complicated flux vacua, and maybe they will make me very happy and eliminate all this landscape. So I'll be talking about several pieces of work. One is over a year old, where the models I'll describe today were given the interpretation I'll use today. These are very old models from the 80s. This is a theory that had its reincarnation in the 80s. It was lattice gauge theory. In the early 90s, it was 2D gravity. And this model I'll be talking about here was actually initiated here at Santa Barbara. And the modern interpretation of this century was given here over the year ago. I gave a talk in this room about a year ago about the worksheet interpretation of these models. An important lesson came in the summer in this work where we showed how the semi-classical approximation is sometimes approximately correct, as we are used to, but also sometimes it's totally wrong. And in a way that the calculation does not tell us. Usually when calculations go wrong, we see that something is singular, or we find infinities and so forth. Here there is no sign for the disease, and I'll show another example of this here. And finally, the bulk of the talk will be a paper I wrote recently with my excellent student, David Shi, who will be in the market next year. Oops. Okay, so the motivation is that the minimal string theory is, okay, I forgot to say the second interpretation of the word minimal is it's based on minimal models, although none of that will be important in today's talk. So these are simple and tractable theories. They have a precise, non-perturbative definition. We have very few of these. And it's kind of, it is interesting because it has all the modern buzzwords, deep brains, holography, and so forth. But this kind of duality is very peculiar and is really unlike all other dualities that we are familiar with, because in this duality, this is the only one I know of, but where both sides of the duality are calculable. Normally, we compute one thing here and one thing there, and then we cross our fingers or we have BPS or something that allows us to interpolate. Here, both sides of the duality are calculable, and that's why it's subjected to more precise tests. The minimal superstring, or the type 0 minimal string, is even more interesting because it can have Ramon-Ramon flux, and it can have D-brains, and they can be charged D-brains, and we will see interesting interplay between the charges and the fluxes. So today we'll talk about the simplest such model, which is just a two-dimensional supergravity, and so forth. So this theory, set of theories, has three perspectives, and it's really very important to keep in mind which of the three we are in at every given moment in time. The simplest one, which most of my talk will be in this one, is the target space. This is where we formulate physical questions. This is where we present the answers. However, here we can't calculate anything. That's very important. So this is good for the discussion, kind of, but the equations are not here. Very few equations can be written here. We can have high curvature, we can have very strong coupling, large fluctuations, and so forth. So we'll have some kind of a toy model in the target space, which exhibits some physical phenomena, but not all, and we'll see how the strong coupling dynamics is going to modify it. So I'm going to start the talk from here, then go to the beef, which is here, and then close the loop and present the answers in terms of the target space. There are two ways to calculate in these models. The worksheet has the advantage that it's somewhat close to the target space. Due to recent developments, the fact that there's large curvature or large fluctuations on the worksheet, this is no longer a problem. These worksheet theories are exactly solvable. We have exact formulas for the disk, the annulus. one-point functions of open strings on the disk or closed strings on the disk, two-point function, three, four, etc. All these things are calculable. I will not do it here. We did all these calculations, that we published them. I'll not present them here. It's kind of technical, and it's a way of scaring the audience, so I won't do that here. But I will mention what the conclusions are. The easiest way to do calculations is using the matrix model or the associated integrable hierarchy. We will show that it's really easy to calculate in these models, both to all orders and perturbation theory, and what's more important, non-perturbatively. We'll see very interesting and surprising non-perturbative effects. Here, all we need to do is solve differential equations. These are classical differential equations. If you want to go to the genus 20, integrate over supermoduli space and so forth, this is trivial. With Mathematica, 5 minutes of work, you get the answer. So the differential equations for the closed strings are known for some 200 years, and for the open strings, they are known for about 100 years. And I'll write the equations here, although I'll not do the mechanics of the calculation here. So at every given moment in the talk, you'll have to remember which of the points of view we are at. But having said that, I'd like to say something which is very general, which was also my feeling in the 90s when I was working on it. Here, it's very easy to do calculations. It's very, very difficult to interpret them. And it's full of pitfalls. And I feel like doing experimental work. You do a calculation, the calculation is relatively easy, you get the answer. So the free energy of the partition function is something. And then comes the interpretation, which is like phenomenology. We look at the data, and the question is, what space-time story are we going to assign to this experimental data? And we will see that the space-time story can be quite elaborate and non-trivial. So the outline, I'll start with the target space description of the theory. This will be very simple and elementary, but of course not precise. Then we'll go to the other extreme and we'll do everything exactly. We'll present the matrix model description of this theory. We'll start with the 80s interpretation, and then we'll move to the 90s interpretation, and then the interpretation of this century. I present the charge brain, so this will be closed strings. Then I'll discuss the charge brains in the system, what kind of charges we have and fluxes, and we will present an exact description of them using the matrix model. And finally, I'll close the loop and tie it all together and give the space-time interpretation of all the experimental data that I'll collect. So what's the target space? The target space is very, very degenerate. It has one dimension, one Euclidean dimension, phi. It's the Liouville field on the world sheet. And we have a linear dilaton. That means that the string coupling is e to the phi. It's very, very weak over there, and it's very strong over there. And that's all there is. There are more elaborate models which have also time and perhaps more, but I will not discuss them here. We'll see that already this is kind of hard, but has surprises. I'm sure the payoff will be larger when we go to more interesting models. So let's start with this one. What are the observables? Well, we sit at the weak coupling end over there, and we change the boundary conditions. This is the analog of performing an S-matrix calculation of throwing something in. So we sit over there, and we change the boundary conditions, and we explore the response of the system to the change in the boundary conditions, i.e., we compute the free energy or the partition function as a function of the slope of various fields at infinity. We also have brains, so the code for this talk is that whenever I use this color, in parentheses, this is slightly more technical. You don't have to follow it. Well, you don't have to follow even the rest, but that's really won't affect the flow. There are also localized D-brains. D-brains, which are localized at the strong coupling end. That's easy to understand intuitively. The mass of the D-brain is 1 over G string. So the D-brain, if you put it here, would like to run over there. So it runs all the way to infinity. And this D-brain has a precise world sheet description. It comes under the technical name of ZZ-brains for the two Zymologicals. So that's what we do. We ask questions over there, and there are some objects over there. And we will see later that we have to be very careful only to ask very precise and meaningful questions. Whenever we ask something which is slightly ill-defined, as is very common in this field, we get into a morass. What are the fields in our one-dimensional theory? Well, we have two scalar fields, and Neve-Schwarz tachyon, whose vacuum expectation value is mu e to the phi, is very negligible. It's negligible over there, and it diverges over there. But the hero of today's story is a scalar field C. It's a Ramon-Ramon scalar, and it has a Lagrangian which roughly has the following form. This is kind of the leading order term in the Lagrangian. So at the weak coupling end, T is 0, so this term is 1, so this is just a standard kinetic term. But the kinetic term for C is different at the strong coupling end. Now, remember, we are in the superstring. This mu can be both positive and negative. The potential on the world sheet is proportional to mu squared. So we can have both positive mu and negative mu. This will soon be important. And correspondingly, the coefficient here, which is 1 over there, can go to 0 or infinity over there. And the behavior of the theory will be dramatically different depending on whether mu is positive or negative. So what are the symmetries of our theory? We have two symmetries that will follow throughout the talk. One is a shift symmetry of the Ramon-Ramon scalar. We can shift it by an arbitrary constant. This is clearly a symmetry of this Lagrangian. And we have a charge conjugation symmetry, flipping the sign of C. I call it charge conjugation because when we have charge in the system, it couples to C. And if we flip the sign of the charge, that corresponds to flipping the sign of C. It's like charge conjugation in electrodynamics. Since we have a continuous symmetry, there is a conserved current. The conserved current is the flux in our system. I'll denote it by Q. Notice that d by d phi of this is 0. This is a consequence of the equation of motion. And it's very important that the coefficient here depends on the tachyon T. So we can integrate this equation. And we want a solution of the equations of motion with non-zero flux. And here it is. Let's give some intuition of what it is. When phi is at the weak coupling end over there, the fact that we have e to the t here is not important. So the solution is C is linear in phi. So we have a constant slope for the scalar field. And the slope of the scalar field is the flux. At the strong coupling end, the behavior is a little bit more interesting, and it depends on the sign of mu. If mu is positive, this thing diverges at the strong coupling end. What does it mean that the profile of a field diverges at the point? What it means is that there's something sitting there which sources the field. This is what happens with D-brains, or more elementary example is an electron. The potential the electron gives is 1 over r. There's a singularity at r equals 0. And what the singularity is telling us is there's something sitting there. The same is true here. When mu is positive, this gadget diverges at the strong coupling end over there. And that means that there's a D-brain localized there. This is the space-time, or I couldn't call it space-time, this is overstatement. This is the target space version of this whole story with the ZZ brain. So the brain sitting at infinity can be charged, and this happens when mu is positive. However, when mu is negative, we have a different phenomenon. This thing converges as phi goes to infinity. It actually goes to zero. There is no singularity, and therefore we can have flux in the system throughout space without being sourced by a D-brain at infinity. So we see that mu positive and mu negative, the theory is dramatically different. It has two different phases for mu positive and mu negative. On one side, we have charged D-brains. And on the other side, we don't have charged D-brains. This is what I wanted to say about the classical, the target space, and now we can go to the exact description, which looks totally unlike the target space that I had. And this started in the 80s, or maybe even the 70s. This is the Gross-Witten model. We have a matrix model based on the following potential. We have a quadratic term, which is has negative sign. We have one coupling constant and m to the fourth. The coefficient here can be rescaled into m. And m is an n by n Hermitian matrix. This is the simplest non-trivial matrix model. The simplest one has only the m square. And the next non-trivial is this one. And when I say non-trivial, I mean matrix model that really exists. We want a matrix integral that is convergent. The matrix model is not convergent, then we don't know what we're doing, and it's full of non-perturbative ambiguities. So this is the simplest model, and we are interested in the partition function, or the free energy f. We compute this integral, take n to infinity. I would really like to stress that this is well-defined. We can put it on the machine and do it numerically. It's a convergent integral. There's really nothing wrong with that. And this is, of course, not the way to solve it, but it's really important that the model is well-defined and has precise definition. It exhibits a large end phase transition. So here is the potential. It's a double well potential. And the eigenvalues of M are distributed between the two minima of the potential. And they repel each other, and they are denoted here by these red dots. So these are the eigenvalues. And the system has two phases. Either the eigenvalues are distributed like that, and they form what they call the two-cut phase of the model, or if we put more eigenvalues, think of it as water, the water goes up, and we have only one line, and when the two cuts touch each other at this point, we have a phase transition. This is a large end phase transition first found by Gross and Witten, although not quite in this model, in the close relative of this model. Instead of changing the number of eigenvalues, we can also change the coefficient of the quartic term in the potential, and this behavior happens at a certain critical value of G, GC. So we are going to zoom on the region of the transition when G is near GC and take the so-called double scaling limit. How do we describe the double scaling limit? In the double scaling limit of this model, this is slightly more technical. So if you don't want to follow the technicalities, that's fine. Just wake up for the physical interpretation. But I want to tell you how one actually computes in these models. So the scaling limit focuses on the transition. And the transition is described by a pair of differential operators, P and Q, whose commutator is 1. These are differential operators in the function mu. And normally in matrix model, they are just ordinary differential operators. In this particular system, they are matrices. They are 2x2 matrices of differential operators. And everything here is determined as a function of two functions of mu. I'll call them R and beta, such that the free energy, or more precisely, the second derivative of the free energy, also known as the susceptibility, is given by R squared. And this was first explored here at Santa Barbara, and then was a lot of follow-up on this system, although not with that target space interpretation. The commutation relation of PQ equals 1 leads to the so-called string equation. This describes everything you want to know about the closed strings in the system. Actually, the second equation here appears only with a d mu of it, which sets to 0 the right-hand side, so that when we integrate it once, we get an integration constant, which I interpret to be the Ramon-Ramon flux, Q. One way to see that is that this system has two symmetries, if you just look at the differential equation. One is shifting beta by a constant is a symmetry of the equations. I interpret it to be the Ramon-Ramon shift symmetry. So the Ramon-Ramon shift symmetry appears as a shift of beta by 1, by a constant, by an arbitrary constant. And we also have our charge conjugation symmetry, which flips the sign of beta. The simplest case is Q equals 0. There is no flux in the system. This beta can be set to 0. And the equation that we get here without the last term is known as the Penn-Levet 2 equation. So this is a classical equation which has all sorts of marvelous properties, which will not be important to us. R is strictly positive. It's easy to prove that there is a solution for all mu when R is strictly positive. I'll soon plot it on the blackboard. And we interpret Q as being the Ramon-Ramon flux. Because of the beta dependence, recall the Ramon-Ramon shift was a shift of beta by a constant. It's natural to define the object Z plus minus is R times e to the plus or minus beta. So recall the shift symmetry shifts beta by a constant. So these objects have charges plus and minus 1 correspondingly. The free energy is neutral. That's good, because it's R squared, which is Z plus times Z minus. Now, there is a marvelous property of the equation. One of the many, many marvelous properties is that this combination, Z plus, is a ratio of two partition functions. Two partition functions with different value of Q. So this is an interesting identity. So let me define, write it here, R e to the plus or minus beta, and z plus minus, which is a function of mu and q, is e to the free energy and mu and q, minus the free energy of mu and q plus or minus 1. So what it means in practice is if somebody handed you the solution of the equation for some value of q, is a differential, this is a complicated differential equation. Somebody hands you the solution. It's no work whatsoever to know the answer for another value of q. You take r and beta for that value of q, you substitute here, and you get the free energy for another value of q. In a sense, this is a very surprising identity, because r is related to the free energy, not the partition function, but the free energy. So this z is like r. It's r times e to the beta. It is like a ratio of two partition functions, not ratio of two free energies, not difference of two free energies, but e to the free energy. So one way of saying this identity is we can think of z plus minus as being an operator in the theory, which bumps the value of q by one. If we think of z as being an expectation value of an operator that bumps the value of q by one, then we understand how it happened. We kill the partition function in the denominator of the expectation value, and you get the partition function at the next value of q. Here is the classical limit of the equation. The classical limit is very simple. We take the differential equation. Wherever we see a derivative, we set it to zero. The differential equation becomes a polynomial equation, and this is the solution. That's for simplicity for q equals zero. When mu is negative, the free energy is mu cubed. So this is the free energy as a function of mu. So out here, it behaves like mu cubed. And out here, it's zero. This is the classical answer, which exhibits a third order transition at mu equals zero. This is the first order this is the transition when the two cuts merge. However, the exact answer is perfectly smooth. So the exact answer looks like that. This is the free energy. It's mu cubed here. It's non-perturbative in mu here. But in between, it's perfectly smooth, and there is no transition. So even though the classical theory exhibits a transition, the transition is kind of a fake. The transition comes from analytically continuing the approximate answer from here down, and analytically continue the approximate answer from here down, rather than following the full answer. This will be very important to us. And already at this level, this might sound alarming, because the behavior of the theory in the two phases, mu positive and mu negative, we call our target space description, was totally different. The theory for mu positive and mu negative exhibited different behavior. Here we see that there is no phase transition between the two different behaviors. So when I talked about the two different phases of the theory, this was a little bit imprecise, because there isn't a phase transition between them. We can see that more explicitly now. Let's expand the differential equation in a power series in 1 over mu. So mu, what's in the worksheet is the cosmological constant. So mu cubed is 1 over g string squared. So this is really the string expansion. And it looks different from mu positive and mu negative. So we expand it in a power series. And we can easily compute all the coefficients here. The numbers are not that important. But the structure of the equation is interesting. First of all, we see that as we increase h, we get suppressions by powers of mu cubed. That's nice. That's consistent with this. These factors are a little bit more interesting. So this happens both from mu negative and from mu positive. These factors are more interesting. Here, we get both even and odd powers of q absolute value. And the power in the denominator is mu to the 3/2. What does it mean? Well, these are d-brains. This is clearly d-brains. How do we see the d-brain? B is the number of boundaries. And they are suppressed by powers of g-string. Not g-string squared, but g-string, hence the mu to the 3/2. And things depend only on the absolute value of q. This is to be distinguished from what happens from mu when mu is negative. Here, we have q dependence, but only even powers of q. We have only even powers of q, and they are suppressed by mu cubed. Well, what's the interpretation of that? Well, that's obvious. Q here is the coefficient of the Ramon-Ramon vertex operator in the action. We can bring it down from the action in perturbation theory. But every time we bring it down, we have to make sure that we have an even number of them. So in this phase, this whole power series expansion is perfectly consistent with having Ramon-Ramon flux in the system without d-brains. That's what gives us even powers of Q. In this phase, we have both even and odd powers of Q with the correct scaling, which is the hallmark of D-brains. We can ask, what's the free energy of one charged D-brain? And the differential equations are smart enough to do exactly the right thing, and that's consistent with our target space interpretation.
Could you say a little bit more about the target space interpretation of the first one? So you've got flux doing what, or how do you create
that? From the wall sheet point of view, you just add to the wall sheet action the Ramon-Ramon vertex operator.
So you're turning on some kind of back, right?
Right. And it's not sourced by D-brain, but it just sits there. The difference between having D-brains and not having D-brains is not in the RR part. The D-brain as a boundary state has an RR part, which is the same, regardless of whether it comes from a D-brain or not. But there's also an SNS part. The NSNS part is what gives the odd powers here, if you look at the disk. See, if we had only the Ramon-Ramon part, the disk would have been zero. The disk is non-zero because of the NSNS part. So that is what gives the odd powers here, but it's absent here. You just look at the answer, and then you just start expanding, and you immediately see how it works. So this differential equation is really smart. It knows about D-brains. It knows about fluxes. So as I said, for mu negative, Q is a pure Ramon-Ramon flux without being sourced by a D-brain. And for mu positive, in this phase, the flux Q arises from charged D-brains. That was what we expected based on the target space Lagrangian, and now we see that the exact theory does the same thing. So this confirms the target space, but I've just told you that the answer, the solution of the differential equation is smooth. These are properties of the expansion around here, or the expansion around here. The exact answer is smooth. So in the exact theory, there isn't a phase transition between having brains or having fluxes. Well, we've seen that before. We've seen that before in the critical string and topological string. This is a lot more concrete because here it's no work whatsoever to carry it out very high order and to rigorously prove that the solution of the differential equation is smooth. This is what mathematicians have been doing for the last two centuries, and they explore these equations. It's also clear if you just look at the equation that, well, I won't explain it. There's a two-line argument that it's smooth. What does it mean in practice? It means something interesting. It means that when I said that there is a D-brain at infinity which sources the flux, this cannot be a precise statement. It cannot be a precise statement because there isn't, for when mu is not infinite, but mu is some number of order one, we can't say whether we are in this regime or in that regime. And therefore, having such a D-brain at infinity is a semi-classical notion which cannot be precise. Because otherwise, it could not have been a smooth transition between this theory with the D-brain and the theory without the D-brain. So this is what I wanted to say about closed strings. The lesson, there are charged brains, there's flux, and we can continuously connect one to the other. But we can also study the D-brains in the system. There are other D-brains in the system. In the 90s, they were called macroscopic loops because we cut a look at the world sheet. This is this brown or whatever color it is over there, and we have a boundary on the world sheet, and that's why it was called the macroscopic loop. It is specified by the length of the boundary. In the world sheet interpretation, it is specified by the length of the boundary or by the boundary cosmological constant mu sub b. From modern terminology, or if you wish, from the target space interpretation, we have a brain. And the brain has an open string tachyon on it. I call it a tachyon even though it's really massive. It's a massive field, which we'll refer to as tachyon, because we use the critical string terminology, whose profile is an exponential of phi with a coefficient mu sub b. So we have a one-parameter family of brains, parameterized by this number mu b, which starts its life as a real number, but it really makes sense to analytically continue it to the entire complex plane. But in particular, it can be either positive or negative.
Not it?
Yeah.
I could just stop for a second. Is this ambiguity, I mean, it sounds like the ambiguity between fluxes and brains might be an artifact of one dimension. Because in higher dimensions, you can imagine finding a charge.
Well, yeah, the same thing is true here. You see, charge will be defined at infinity. I'll actually make a big point of this. What is well-defined? We'll see that there were many other things here which are ill-defined. And in the end, we'll see what is well-defined. Please, I'll answer this question more than you want to hear. You'll regret asking this question. So, what does the brain look like? Well, the brain has a wave function. Imagine, for simplicity, that phi, the coordinate phi around the disk, is constant. In the two, if you think of it as two-dimensional gravity, the appropriate name would be mini-superspace approximation. So we ask, what's the amplitude, what's the disk amplitude as a function of the boundary phi? That's easy to see. We just take the disk and we ignore all the fields. Nothing depends on where we are around the disk. And all we need to do is put t square here. It's t square rather than t because we are in the superstring. So that's not an important distinction. And e to the minus t square is e to the minus mu b square e to the phi, which is a very beautiful function. It looks like that. It's approximately flat here. See, because when phi goes to minus infinity, this is zero, so the whole wave function goes to one. So it's very flat over there. It comes in. And then very rapidly, when it's a given value of phi of order log mu b, there's a crossover, and the function goes to zero very rapidly. What does it mean in practice? It means in practice that this is a good observable. We sit here at the weak coupling end, and we take our brain, which looks like a D1 brain, and we stick it in. And then at some point in the target space, the brain dissolves. Where does it dissolve? Well, this is a parameter that we can tune. We can take this stick and stick it deeper and deeper. So we are going to use this as our probe of our geometry and of our flux. We'll bring it in and we'll ask what happens when it moves to the strong coupling end, and then we'll pull it back out and see what happens. I'd like to make a few analogies with that, because this is a, despite appearance, it's actually a familiar fact, the fact that the brain dissolves like that. The simplest example of that is the unstable brain story that was very popular over the last few years. And I'll first derive some results from it, and then I'll make the analogy more complete. There's a coupling on the wall sheet, in the theory of the brain that depends on this closed string tachyon T open, and it couples to the background Ramon-Ramon scalar C. So we had a closed string field C, which couples to the profile of the brain, which is approximately a delta function, so it's really localized near the region where the brain decays. So the way to think of the brain is exactly like this stick, except that it is infinitely long in this direction. It dissolves here, and in the region where it dissolves, it couples to the background Ramon-Ramon field, or in other words, it carries charge. We have localized charge around the end of the probe. Okay, so we have some charge which is localized in this region. It's not really a point, it is a little bit smeared. Recall the profile, so in this region we have some localized charge, not here and not here. So here we have some localized charge, and it couples to the C field and hence the charge. Now I claim, I'd like to say two things about it. First of all, it's proportional to the sine of mu b. That's just easy to understand, either if you read the appropriate papers of the unstable brain, or by remembering that C is odd under charge conjugation and T is odd under charge conjugation. So that means that if we flip the sign of T open, the charge, the coefficient of C, should change. In other words, the point in target space where the brain dissolves depends on mu b absolute value, and the sign of mu b tells us whether the brain carries charge plus or minus. The other thing which is important is the coefficient a half here. In the same unit where Q was quantized before, the brains carry charge, quantized charge, this brain has half a unit of charge. I'll soon prove that from many different points of view, but let me first state it. So we have this charge localized at the point phi zero. So this is a picture of the target space. This is the weak coupling end. This is the strong coupling end. Here is the brain coming from infinity. I should do it like this. The brain comes from infinity here and dissolves. And around this region, we have charge, localized charge, Q sub B, the charge of the brain. Well, what does the charge do? It changes the flux from being Q here to Q plus QB here. So depending on whether QB is positive or negative, the flux here is Q, and here Q plus a half or minus a half. So the flux here at the weak coupling end, which I'll call Q weak, is what an observer at infinity would measure. And the flux here is different. because we have this domain wall which changes the flux. So the closed string background is parameter Q that we discussed before, is what happens in the strong coupling end, not at the weak coupling end. This is not really a wave function in the sense of probability. It's the disk amplitude as a function of the boundary condition on the disk. This is an object which sits at every phi with the same amplitude.
We know in this where the end of the brain is, but how do you know it's not a brain extending from strong coupling to this point as opposed to the other way around?
Because of the profile was e to the minus mu b squared e to the phi.
Thing, the brain is where that takes on whatever the constant value.
Right. It's constant over there, and then it goes rapidly to zero. It's a very rapid function. It's e to the phi. I'd really like to stress the similarity and the distinction from the unstable brain. So it's very similar in the following sense. If you look at these papers of the unstable brains, and there is a D1 brain, there is an open string tachyon living on that brain, and it has a double well potential. And the open string tachyon can either fall here or fall there. That would mean that the whole D1 brain decays. But it can also fall half of space here and half of space there and leave behind the kink. So when a D1 brain, which was originally neutral, decays, it can decay to a kink. That the open string tachyon here is at one minimum of the potential, the open string tachyon here is at the other end of the potential, and in between, we have a D0 brain that remains. So this is the analogy, and the analogy is actually very, very precise. All the couplings are the same, except two crucial differences. Number one, our open string tachyon is not a tachyon, but it's a massive field. That's the first distinction. So our brains are perfectly stable. This is an open string field. It has the quantum numbers of the tachyon. It's kind of the same vertex operator. But it's massive, so it's not going to roll down. Second, T open varies between 0 and plus or minus infinity. So we don't have a full kink. The analogy is what we have is half a kink. So going back to the picture, if we wanted to have a full kink, we would decay here and have charge half, and we will decay at the other end and have the other half. But we have only half a kink. It's like being at the top of the potential and going to the minimum. It's not really a good analogy because we don't have an upside down potential, but potential that looks like that. So we have a half a kink, and hence the plus or minus a half. That's why the charge is a half rather than one. This will soon be very important, that this guy is normalizing units of a half. And it's clear why the sign here is determined by mu b, or the sign of mu b. It tells us whether the kink falls to this vacuum or to that vacuum. This is the difference in sign between a brain and an anti-brain, and that's how it arises. So now let's have an inventory of the brains in the system. And we ignore this brain at infinity, at the strong coupling end, because we've already said that even though it makes sense semi-classically in the wall shape, but it's not really precise non-perturbatively. But we have these brains, and these brains are good objects. They're good objects because they are defined at the weak coupling end. We come from infinity at the weak coupling end, and we stick a probe in to explore what the system does. So this is the charge of the brain. And semi-classically, we have two different brains. We can start with mu b positive, and hence qb is positive. So we come here. We go to the strong coupling end. We bring mu b to 0. And then we are continually, analytically continue in mu b, which means we pull it back out. So this is one thing we can do. And then we have a brain which has charge plus a half, because it started its life with positive mu b. There is another brain with charge minus a half, which started its life with negative mu b. It looks exactly the same. We come from here. We go to the strong coupling end, and then we pull it back out. It's an analytic function. So we analytically continue it to mu b positive, and therefore we have brains which charge a plus a half and minus a half. And I'd like to stress that if you use this technology of mostly of the Zama logicals, of using worksheet computations, they confirm this picture. And everything here is calculable up to the order of the annulus with worksheet methods. So we have two brains. The brains are labeled by where they started their life, not by mu b. I'm going to argue that this is wrong. This semi-classical picture is wrong. In fact, you should have suspected it's wrong, because when I presented the brain, the charge of the brain was a function of the sine of mu b. So I don't need to analytically continue right, left, and right. Who cares? There's some mu b. I measure mu b. I should know the charge of the brain. So something in the semi-classical approximation has to give. And of course, what will give is the thing, the only assumption I didn't spell out. Yes? So in order for you not to fall asleep, or to make it be easier for you to follow what will actually happen, I'm giving a preview for what the system really does. And what the system does is the following. The mistake, first of all, in the semi-classical approximation is in the analytic continuation. This is where we make a mistake. The analytic continuation of the semi-classical answer is not the same as the semi-classical limit of the analytic continuation. Semi-classical limit and analytic continuations don't commute. This is known as Stokes phenomenon, and this is happening here all over the map. Instead, as expected from the target space, the distinct brains are labeled only by the sign of mu b. So what happens physically when we bring the brain in all the way to infinity and then we pull it back out? The only way this could make sense is that the charge of the brain changes. So I'm going to argue that the brain started its life with charge localized here being plus a half, as expected from the simple target space picture. I bring it in, and then I pull it back out, and it comes back with charge minus a half. And if you look puzzled, I promise you, you will not be puzzled by the end of the talk and say, how could you have expected otherwise? So not only, well, so the charge of the brain will change as mu b varies. It's not going to contradict anything you learned in school. So I continue the preview. We start with mu b positive. This is our brain. It comes from infinity. The flux here is q. It has plus a half. The flux here is q plus a half. I pull it back in, and then I pull it back out. And when I pull it back out, it will come back with charge minus a half. The flux at the weak coupling end is not going to change. That cannot possibly change. However, the flux in the strong coupling region is going to hop by 1 unit. That's why it's very important that this thing is normalized in a half, because the flux here is normalized to be integers. So I'm going to get 1/2 in and 1/2 out. One way to think about it is the following. Imagine we have a big capacitor. There's a capacitor plate at the strong coupling end. And here we have charge plus a half. So we bring it to the capacitor plate here. We touch, and then we pull back out. And it deposits 1 unit of charge there, and it comes back out with charge minus a half. So this is the picture I want you to keep in mind. How can we prove all that? This was a nice physical picture, but why should it be true? In order to do that, we have to go back to the matrix model. And there are two natural objects in the matrix model, which are actually the same object, from the two different perspectives. One is in terms of the matrices. In terms of the matrices, the D brain is the determinant of the matrix minus a constant. And the constant that can be put here is identified as the boundary cosmological constant mu b. For the matrix model experts in the audience, we can think of this determinant as e to the trace log. And if you differentiate the trace log, you get the resolvent. So this is a close relative of the resolvent of the matrix model. And the exponentiation is the statement that the resolvent gives us one boundary on the worksheet, and the D brain gives us sum of all number of boundaries, one boundary, two boundaries, three boundaries, and hence the exponentiation. So this is a D brain. And that's why it starts with a D. So that's a natural object in terms of the matrices. What is the natural object in terms of the differential operator? So here it's going to be a little bit technical, but bear with me and wake up when I finish the technicalities. Recall that all the closed string information is parameterized by these differential operators, P and Q. So we have these differential operators, which are 2x2 matrices whose commutator is 1. Given such differential operators, the most natural thing to do is to diagonalize them. This is known in the math literature as the Baker-Akiyese function. So Q is a differential operator in mu. It's a 2x2 matrix, so we need two functions, psi plus and psi minus. And the eigenvalue here is our friend mu sub b, the boundary cosmological constant. Similarly, p acts on this as minus d by d mu b. So we're looking for two functions, which are kind of eigenfunctions of q and p. This is a very natural mathematical construction. For the people who know about matrix model, I should say that these are essentially the two kinds of orthogonal polynomials. This is a scaling limit of the orthogonal polynomials. And we have two of them here because the even and odd n are different. And I wrote it here, and this is in this notation that you don't have to pay attention to. What's the physical interpretation? The system has two different brains, b plus and b minus, with partition function, that. And these wave functions, these psi that I had on the previous transparency, is the partition function of the system with the brain, normalized with a closed string partition function. So in terms of the genus expansion, we have it all number of handles and all number of boundaries, at least with at least one, because everything which doesn't touch the brain is kind of a disconnected piece, which is taken care of by this factor. So these are the equations with all their glory. The details are not important, but I would like to stress that it is as explicit as possible. You can put it in the machine. All the closed string data determines R and beta. That comes from the closed string equations. You calculate Z plus minus. Just take this thing, and you plug it here. And if you work in perturbation theory in a power series of 1 over mu, I work this expansion of these guys to very high order, and I solve these equations in a power series in 1 over mu to rather high order, and it's relatively straightforward. This is really as well defined as possible. In fact, mathematicians have been studying exactly these equations for over a century now. It's exactly these equations, although not quite without interpretation with D-brains. These equations, even though the coefficients are not that important today, there's a root 2 and a 4 and all that, that's not important, but some things are obvious from the structure of the equation, in addition to the fact that it's very explicit. See, we said that Z plus and Z minus carry charge plus or minus 1 under this our shift symmetry, which is the Ramon-Ramon shift symmetry. That's consistent with psi plus and psi minus carrying charge plus or minus a half. You see that all the off-diagonal terms depend on beta. So they carry charge, and the diagonal terms don't. So for example, here we hit Z plus with psi minus has charge minus a half, we hit it with plus one, we get an object which has charge plus one. So our charge assignment, including the fact that the D-brain charge is half of the basic units of the theory, follows also from the equation. So these are some consequences of the equations. The brains have charge plus or minus a half, I already said that. The solution of the differential equations are smooth functions of mu and mu b. You can think of them as being a vector field. It's a flat connection. You exponentiate the flat connection. You clearly get a smooth function. There's no room for singularity. And naively, this agrees with our semi-classical picture, namely two different brains, one with the label plus and the other with the label minus, associated with these two different functions, p and q, with 2x2 dimensional matrices, except that when we try to compare with worldsheet, so we expanded that to high order, and we compare with the disk and annulus calculations that can be done explicitly, b plus matches for positive mu b, and b minus matches only for negative mu b. That's associated with a very peculiar identity that can be proved essentially by taking the differential equation and plugging the solution in. So recall our friend Z plus minus was a ratio of two partition functions. I copied it here for you to remember. And the surprising identity is the following. The function psi plus, which is known, is a function of three variables, mu, which is the closed string tachyon, q, which is the Ramon-Ramon flux, and mu b, which is the boundary cosmological constant. For value at q plus 1, psi minus is determined entirely in terms of data at q. So that cuts down the number of independent brains by a half, which is a step in the right direction. In fact, since this Z is a ratio of two partition functions of closed strings, we can write this identity in a much more transparent form as follows. So it's an inequality between two expectation values. The brain plus with Ramon-Ramon flux Q is the same as the brain minus with Ramon-Ramon flux Q plus one. I'd really like to stress that this identity is not an approximation. It's not an approximation. It's not something that is true semi-classically or to all orders in the semi-classical space. This is an exact property of the theory. The D brains, the exact D brains, satisfy this identity. So there are only half as many independent flux brain configuration relative to what one might have thought semi-classically. I'd like to give an interpretation of all that, the target space interpretation. So if you fell asleep when you saw all these horrible equations, this is the time to wake up. The equation described, the equation depends on the parameter Q, and we have two different brains. Q weak is Q plus or minus a half, depending on the label here. So the subscript here is not charge. This is, whatever comes out of the matrix model has to be well defined. Whatever we say in the target space could be ill-defined, because this is where we don't understand what we are doing. So the label here, which is well-defined, tells us what the flux at the weak coupling end is as a function of Q. So B plus, I claim, has its natural charge, which is plus a half when mu B is positive, and it has its natural charge when QB is minus a half when mu B is negative. So this is the charge assignment. Both of these situations have flux Q in the strong coupling end. So this is where we set it up. We set it up for one sign of mu B or the other sign of mu B with either B plus or with B minus. This is my favorite picture. The flux here is Q. This is the charge of the brain is QB, and the flux at the weak coupling end is Q plus QB. And I've already said that Q is the flux here at the strong coupling end, which will end up not being a good way to parameterize the data. When we analytically continue B plus minus to the other sign of mu B, and I really stress here, we analytically continue the exact answer, not the semi-classical approximation to the exact answer, but the full exact answer. QB changes from to minus QB, and the flux in the strong coupling end jumps to plus or minus one while preserving Q weak. In fact, if we take the exact answer, expand it in perturbation theory for the two signs, so we have the two signs of mu and the two signs of mu b, and we have psi plus and psi minus, so there's a number of calculations we have to do. If we recall this dictionary, things do match with the semi-classical approximation. So things do match with the semi-classical approximation, provided we remember to change the sign of QB and the value of the flux at the strong coupling end. Otherwise, they don't agree. The surprising identity is now somewhat less surprising, because it equates two different ways of setting up the same physical situation. Both the left-hand side and the right-hand side have the same flux at the weak coupling end. The flux at the weak coupling end is something that has to be very precise. This is something that is rigorously defined, and observer sits very, very far, and he or she measures the flux there. So these two brains have Q weak, which is Q plus a half. Now let's explore this identity when mu B is, say, positive. So this brain started its life at this point, at mu B positive. It has this charge. And the flux at the strong coupling end is Q. This brain, on the other hand, is more naturally defined for the other sign of mu B, where its charge is minus a half. And Q strong is that. That's what this identity says. However, in order to equate the two, they should have the same value of mu B, which means that we have to take this guy that started its life here, bring it to the capacitor plate, and then pulling it back out. In the process of doing that, it was transmuted to a brain with the opposite charge. So first of all, we conclude that the distinct flux brain configurations are labeled by only the flux at the weak coupling end and the complex parameter mu B. We can change mu B. This will change the charge, but we do not get another factor of two in addition to that. This agrees with the target space. It also resolves the discrepancy with the worksheet. And I've already said that this phenomenon is a Stokes phenomenon, that the mistake in the worksheet was to analytically continue an approximate answer. But the main surprise from that is not that the transition happened. OK, now we see that it doesn't violate anything. The main surprise is the transition is smooth. It's okay that this guy came to the capacitor plate, deposited charge, and came back out. It doesn't violate charge conservation. So that the immediate objection is gone. But how can it be smooth? How can it be that we touch the end? In electrodynamics, if we do that, this is clearly a singular process. There's a singularity there. Here, it's a perfectly smooth function. What does it mean that it's smooth? It has a number of consequences. So let's review the picture again. From UB positive, we have charge plus a half. From UB negative, we have charge minus a half. This is the transition. The flux here jumped, and the charge here jumped. So what does it mean? Q weak is well defined. It does not fluctuate. This is really a rigorously defined concept. This is associated with the fact that the weak coupling region has infinite volume. So the flux there in the infinite volume region cannot fluctuate. However, if you have something that varies continuously between being plus a half and minus a half, it's clearly not a well-defined concept. So the charge of the brain, which was well-defined semi-classically, Q sub B, and correspondingly the flux in the strong coupling region, is also not well-defined. It can fluctuate. This is the only way we can have smooth transition changing the charge. See, there are two possibilities. Either the charge is well-defined, and then we must have a singularity when the charge jumps, or the charge is not well-defined, and then it's not surprising that the transition is smooth. How can we think of it? Well, it's very simple. If we think that the strong coupling end, namely the distance between the end of the brain and the capacitor plate, is being finite distance. If this is really finite distance, there is no surprise, because the charge can start hopping before we touch the singularity, before we touch the plate. So they are this is all non-perturbative. It cannot happen in perturbation theory. Non-perturbatively, flux can jump from the end of the brain to the capacitor plate and back. So this brain, once it's very far out there, its charge is well-defined. It's finding it very difficult to jump. But as we bring it in, the charge can jump back and forth, making the charge of the brain, the localized charge of the brain, ill-defined. However, as we pull the brain back out, it's very difficult for the charge to jump. And since it's very difficult for the charge to jump, it freezes. And it freezes, and the flux of the strong coupling end also freezes. An analogy is really being called for. This is a lot like a first-order phase transition. In a first-order phase transition, if we calculate, so we set, say, at this minimum, we vary the parameters, there's a first-order phase transition, and we continue to vary the parameters. In a semi-classical physicist, we just stay in the wrong vacuum. And there is no sign, he or she do not have any sign that they're doing anything wrong. To all orders in perturbation theory, everything makes sense. Only non-perturbatively will you jump to the other vacuum. So this is the semi-classical mistake. The semi-classical mistake was to analytically continue a first-order transition through the transition. So how come that we got something smooth here and there wasn't a phase transition in the end of the day? Because the analogous thing is a first-order phase transition, but in finite volume. We have a first-order phase transition with finite volume. There isn't really a transition. We start here. Most of the time, the system is here. As we get closer and closer, there are large fluctuations between the two minima. And in the end, the fluctuations also go, and they favor the other minimum. And it very, very far, we are entirely here. This is very much like the D-brain here. The brain has charge plus a half or minus a half. It's almost entirely with one charge here. As we come closer, the fluctuations become larger. They are non-perturbative, so a semi-classical physicist doesn't see that. And as we pull it back out, it freezes again, but with another value. So the volume of the strong coupling end from here is clearly going to be small until we pull mu b to infinity. So what are the lessons of this talk? First of all, we discussed solvable models, and solvable models are always fun. The difficult thing is always to extract the right physics from them, and the physics that is generalized to more generic, more interesting systems. And I'm giving you no money-back guarantee that the lessons I gave today are the right lessons from these models, but I'm sure they are right lessons from these models, maybe not these ones. So they're solvable, and it's very, very explicit and rigorously defined. That's good. For mu positive, the flux was generated by charged D brains in the strong coupling region. For mu negative, there are no such brains, but the flux still exists. We saw this transmutation of brains to flux, but there was a smooth transition between these two extreme situations. And the smooth transition really tells us that this charged brain cannot be rigorously defined. So this is what we learned about closed strings. And about D brains and open strings, we'll learn the following fact. There are extended D brains in the system. These are the brains which come from infinity. They dissolve in the interior. Near the point where they dissolve, semi-classically, they carry charge, which is plus or minus a half. But this charge, which was well-defined and meaningful classically, is not meaningful in the quantum theory. Similarly, the flux in the strong coupling end is not meaningful in the quantum theory. Both of them can fluctuate. The only thing which is really meaningful is the flux at the weak coupling end. And one way to show that is that there is a smooth transition changing the flux, the charge of the brain as we bring it in, touch the capacitor plate, and pull it back out. So I think I'll stop here.
So we see, I think, things like this in higher dimensions, and you know, these transitions in the landscape, for example, where brains can nucleate and neutralize flux. That's roughly analogous. But how, you mentioned something at the beginning about maybe killing the landscape or something. I'm curious what.
Well, one thing that we see here is that the distinct flux brain configuration is smaller than what one might naively have thought. That takes only care of a factor of two. And but putting a more positive spin on this, I was very surprised by this phenomenon, by the two phenomena. That things that semi-classically well-defined, that were obviously good and right. And so the D brain at infinity is not well-defined, that goes away. The charge of the brain, which I always thought was well-defined, goes away. And even there, when you nucleate, it doesn't tell you that the background is exactly the same, not approximately the same. The background is rigorously exactly the same to all orders in perturbation theory and even non-perturbatively. In fact, the non-perturbative part of it is what's really important. Because this is a non-perturbative phenomenon. So the more positive thing is that there's room for lots of surprises. And we should not just despair now and say, oh, we have all these vacua, and therefore we should go anthropic and invoke God or whoever. This is premature.
Does this brain in the strong coupling region really exist?
Semi-classically, it does. It exists.
But in the full theory,
if you expand the full answer in the semi-classical approximation, worksheet methods will be excellent to compute the coefficients. And you should really think about it as a D-brain. In that sense, it exists. But when
it exists as an approximation.
It exists as an approximation. Mm-hmm. In the full theory, if G-string is not epsilon, but it's 10 to the minus 100, it no longer exists. It's no longer a meaningful concept.
But without changing the parameters of the theory, is there a way for an observer at infinity to know that there's a D-brain?
Well, that's the reason why it's not well defined. Only things which are can be defined over there are meaningful. Whatever we do here locally,
there's no way to define it.
Well, semi-classically, there is.
No, but that's varying parameters.
Right.
Just an observer living in that
theory. Then you cannot do that. Well, but with the mu b is the same thing. If you have to vary mu b, do this experiment of pushing it in and pulling it out. So that's how.
But that's something an observer could do.
Right. The observer cannot change mu. It cannot change the closed string, but it can change it, this and that. So performing it's a real experiment. There's a knob. He changes the knob, and the knob pushes it in, and then he changes it further, and it comes back out. It's a physical, it's not the real world. It's a one-dimensional Euclidean. Okay, so that's actually a good thing. So the next step, which is something I'm working on now, is do the same thing at the C hat equals 1. And of course, everything I told you is still true. Same thing happens there. Except that there are many new subtleties, which are room for more surprises. There are two kinds of Ramon-Ramon fluxes, electric and magnetic in a sense. And as long as you have only one of them present, what I told you today can just be copied. But when both of them are present, I don't yet have a coherent picture, and I'm almost sure that something will have to give, because the semi-classical approximation, again, is completely wrong. So this is an open direction, so adding time to this.
Any other questions? Okay, let's thank the speaker again.